on this episode of Suspect Zero, the case of Michael Scott Magliolo.
Michael Scott Magliolo, a McDonald's employee in Texas, would hitch rides with truck drivers and travel the country. Depending on the location, he would go on the prowl for a murder victim. Magliolo denies he had anything to do with what he was accused of, but then confronted with an indictment, he confesses and gives details into the crimes. He details what happened to Donna Baycott. He says he had hitched a ride with a trucker and was hanging at a bar when he met these two girls. Once Donna goes back into the hotel room with him and refuses to give him what he wants, he tells investigators he took it. Once convicted, he was sentenced to 51 years, and at the age of 60, he's incarcerated at the Northeast Correctional Complex in Mountain City, Tennessee. Michael has since told reporters that he has executed 12 people, but he hasn't been charged with them, as he has never provided any further information. Welcome to Suspect Zero, where we not only discuss unsolved cold cases, but serial killers whose crimes are lesser known or virtually unknown, yet the most terrifying. I'm Dawn Washburn, and joining me is my co-host, Dr. Michael Arntfield. Hello, Michael.
Hey, Dawn, how's things?
Things are going well. How about you?
More of the same.
So, Michael, I was researching this case, not only for the podcast, but to raise awareness to our students. And I stumbled on an article that really had me thinking about the occupations of serial killers and how these occupations are not only helpful to the killers in selecting their victims, but also allows them to remain on the surface a productive member of society. You know, they hide under this facade and mask of normalcy when in reality, their true occupation would stun any profession. So would we then consider their profession a pastime and secondary to their real pursuits? Some murderers are construction workers, as we covered in our Israel Keys episode. Some are narcissistic enough to become cops. And the nomadic and unskilled killers tend to work where they have no real commitment. So in today's episode, we'll be discussing Michael Scott Magliolo, a nomad who would hitch rides with truckers to carry out his quests around Nashville, Ohio, and quite possibly any other places that we are unaware of. Ironically, as I was looking at who the expert and author of the article was, Michael, I realized this is a Dr. Michael Arntfield special. I didn't even realize that until I was halfway through the article. And I said, wait a minute, let me go back and check who the author of this article is, because it's really good and informative. So I noticed that in the conversation, as it was called, you had written an article regarding all of this that we're discussing right now. So just curious what you can add to that.
Well, it's not just an article or a series of articles. It's actually in this case of Michael Scott Magliolo is in my book, Monster City, which was published in 2018 and is basically a tell-all of the unheard of serial killings in Music City. So a parody of Music City, Monster City is, and a lot of people don't know this, but at the height of the new country sort of phase of the 90s. I mean, the country's very mainstream now, but new country in the 90s really allowed Nashville to explode and people moved there to ride this wave, and including serial killers who were also aspiring country musicians or, like you mentioned, people whose occupations drew them to Nashville. The place was full of aspiring stars and starlets, and they were all easy targets for some of these killers, including Magliolo.
Wow, it's incredible to even hear that, you know, because you think you're going for a better life and starting something new, and mainly you could potentially become a target, you know, or even the offender.
That's right.
So I guess, you know. All right, so let me give a little background on the case. It's October 4th, 1991, and homicide detective Pat Pastiglione gets a call that there is a body found in a nearby motel called the Esquire. The Esquire is located on Dickerson Road in Lower East Nashville, which in the 90s was considered a high crime area where homicides were frequent occurrence, especially including prostitutes. The area kind of yielded that kind of activity. As he enters room 23, he sees the body of a 24-year-old woman on the floor, naked and displayed in an explicit manner. She's left with only socks on, her legs spread open, which suggests sexual assault, and a ligature around her neck. There looked to be a fight, a struggle, then an assault. And one unusual detail that was on the scene was there was a pillow placed on the victim's face. And also, in addition to the victim, her jeans were cut from her body in a very meticulous and strategic way, either with scissors or a knife. Another item was a man's shirt with blood on it and four beer cans with condensation on them, which would suggest that the suspect was not too far ahead of them. So the motel clerk tells investigators that the man who signed into room 23 signed his name as Terry Duncan on the card that you need to get into the hotel. He also tells police that he had walked to the motel, which could indicate that he was a nomad or even possibly a truck driver. He also described him as being white, clean cut, brown hair, blue eyes, about 5'8" and 150 pounds. So Michael, that's not enough information to go on at that point, but it's definitely a start in the right direction. So thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty generic description, but right. We've got a couple of immediate clues. Number one, we have perimortem, or at the time of death, and postmortem activity with the body, which is pretty unusual. A part of it could form, we don't know yet, but perhaps part of a recurring signature. So in terms of offender behaviors, the modus operandi or what they do to carry out their crime, we now know can fluctuate. It's not consistent. Some killers would prefer to strangle, but they carry a knife as a backup. And so you have one victim who's strangled, one who's stabbed. The MO has just changed according to circumstance. They have a preferred MO, but the signature is something that is almost unchanging and seldom changing, because this is something that needs to be done. It's not even instrumental to successfully carrying out the crime. It is something that is meaningful only to the offender, and which they will do by necessity in every case. So posing, we see, is among the more recurring of signatures among serial killers. And when you see that type of postmortem activity, number one, Postiglione knows he's probably dealing with a serial killer. And number two, we've got a name, fake name, as it turns out, but a name and a zip code that the killer has committed to, and also a handwriting sample. So there's a lot, even by 90 standards, for the cops to go on right away.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. And also, I remember reading that the detective also, with the cutting of the clothes, felt that that wasn't normal. That was part of the ritual, because typically, you know, you could just rip the clothes off, but to cut them in the way that he did just seemed that it would be something that he would do to even prolong, you know, the act of what he was doing, and also to make some sort of mark, you know, that was relative to himself.
Yeah, there's elements of sadism here for sure. Prolonging the cutting, the terrorizing of the victim, as well as, this wasn't a conventional ligature strangulation. He essentially created a makeshift tourniquet out of a towel and that he took from the motel bathroom and slowly crushed her windpipe. So, I mean, right away we know we're dealing with someone who's done this before. And that's Postiglione's hunch, and it turns out to be right.
Right. Now, they didn't know who the victim was. So at the time, he puts a picture, the detective puts a picture out in the newspaper in hopes of someone identifying her. So not too soon after, her husband, Doug Baycott, shows up at the police department telling police that his wife had been missing for a few days. And then that's when they identify the body. I believe the husband and the sister identified the body as Donna Baycott.
That's right.
So it occurs to the detective that he needs to contact various agencies to see if he could find any cases that are similar to this case. So he starts to make inquiries to similar crimes, and eventually he reaches Cincinnati, Ohio, and is made aware of a case that was similar in nature. And this was the Ida Mae Bladen case. Both victims had pillows over their faces. The suspect signed into the motel as being from Texas, and used the alias now of Scott Campbell. The birthdays both matched, and there also was a fingerprint at the scene as well. So, and as you said, the zip code that he put on both the registrations at the motel traced back to Texas. And the detective made a comment that nobody could really guess a zip code on the fly like that. So it would have to be something that he would know already.
That's right. So let's think about the time frame we're dealing with in the early 90s. And so there's no Google, there's no, I mean, there's rudimentary internet, which is pretty rare. It's not as though if you had been planning these crimes, you could just Google an address the way you can now and get the corresponding zip code or postal code. So operating on instinct, the killer making up different aliases when he signs into these dive motels and hotels reverts to the one postal code that he knows, which is his own, or the one zip code he knows, which is his own. And that's when we look at an offender's fabricated account of something, or when we look at a forged document, the way he's forged these motel registers, there's always frequently, well, in many cases, some semblance of truth to them. There's always something contained in these elaborate ruses that will lead back to to the real story and help identify who's behind this. So in this case, it's not so much handwriting analysis that links both of these registers. It's that common zip code. And this tells detectives that this is someone either from Texas originally reverting to the one zip code that they know, or someone, again, given that we're dealing with two different states, who is on the road and they call Texas home when they're not out killing.
Right. And you and I had spoken a little bit earlier before we started the podcast, but you pointed out that the detective had called Texas many times about, because they couldn't get a hit on the fingerprint. So that would insinuate that the person's never really been arrested for anything. So they didn't, or wasn't in the system. So they couldn't really, so explain that, because I think that was a part that you had mentioned earlier.
So yeah, fingerprints are not, I mean, I think people think that this technology has been around forever and you get a fingerprint and you run it through a system and you get a hit if the person's ever been arrested. I mean, by the early 90s, this was still not a fully developed technology. So the automated fingerprint identification system, or AFIS, I mean, is really in its early days. You have not even every state, or certainly nowhere close to every police department, that is on the system or able to upload prints to this system. So you would have to frequently go to police departments one at a time and say, can you compare this print? So for instance, the print recovered from the Cincinnati murder, and compare it manually, or in some cases using their own internal database, to anything you may have on file locally. So this is really what he has to do, is hunt and peck around the country. So he obviously looked, so Ohio and Tennessee are separated only by Kentucky. So I mean, he goes to Kentucky, various agencies in Kentucky. He goes to throughout the Midwest, but it's this nagging zip code that comes back to the Dallas area that leads him to believe that this is likely where the killer resides and where he's most likely to have been printed. And when he initially does this, there are no prints, and he keeps hounding them, and he keeps sending, you know, every month, and then every week. And sure enough, while he's doing this, the killer comes into the orbit of the local police and his prints are taken, and eventually there's a match.
Right. He's pulled over, right, for a DUI, I think. And that was the hit. That was what they needed.
That's right. Not even a violent crime. He's cruising around with a bunch of jailbait underage teenage girls that he's picked up. Who knows where, drawing attention to himself. Police see this, pull him over, and yeah, he's over the limit. So he gets booked for DWI, DUI, whatever you want to call it. And prints end up in the local system. And then the next time Pat Postiglione calls back, there you go. And it's a match to the Cincinnati murder. And then a match in terms of circumstantial MO-based evidence at that point to the Nashville murder.
Right, and then he flies there because he wants a confession, and he wants to get that confession pretty quickly. So he flies there to talk to him and see if he'll confess to what he's done. And initially, when they get him in the interrogation room, he clearly denies it. You know, it's the first thing he does, until they tell him that they have an indictment on him. And then from that point, he just starts spilling it, you know, well, he spilled what he knew they knew, which were the two cases at that time. So, so he started explicitly describing what he did to these poor victims, which, you know, going back to the hotel, he was in a bar and he was hanging out at this bar and he noticed Donna there with her sister. And they started hanging out. And then after they were hanging out, they had gone back to the sister's house, who then got upset because her children were there. And she said, you can't stay here. So they leave there and they go to that motel, room 23. And I guess at that point, and he clearly says to them, you know, she refused to give me what I wanted, so I took it. And that's, you know.
And that was the plan all along. And I mean, it's just interesting that both of his confirmed murders, so he's got two confirmed victims, which qualifies him as a serial killer. But there are many more suspected, including as far south as Louisiana. But I mean, it's interesting that the common denominator is the motel. And it's by design that he gets his victims there. If he had been able to stay at Donna's house or the sister's house, we'll never know if she would have survived. But once he's in a motel or hotel, it's almost as though it's his turf. It's part of the MO. It's where he's comfortable operating. He signs in under assumed identities with fake information. It's all cash based. It's untraceable. These are low rent, often, you know, by the day, by the hour, even hotels and motels. So he knows this life, and this is tied in. You mentioned occupation. This is tied into his, what we would call, avocation. So his day job, so to speak, is he worked at McDonald's and was actually on track to go to Berger College in Illinois and become a McDonald's manager.
Right.
But on his days off, he worked as what we call a lumper. And this is someone who hitches rides with long-haul truckers and essentially hitchhiking, but in exchange, you help the trucker offload whatever they're hauling. So, and there's a whole underground economy doing this. So he would find his way to trucking hubs, Nashville being one of them, and from there just ride these rigs all over the country with the promise of offloading wherever the trucker's destination was, and then he'd jump on another truck and do the same thing and be gone for days and weeks at a time. And in reality, he's completely off the grid. So the trucker, there'll be a record of the trucker being in the city because there'll be a bill of lading, there'll be you know, witnesses who, including at the trucking companies, who know that that's his route, that that's where he's going. But Magliolo is just a phantom along for the ride, who's given the trucker a fake name. He doesn't need ID, he's paying for everything in cash, and he just floats in and out of these cities on these trucks and kills people. And it's chilling just how remarkably well thought out all of this is. I mean, it is, it's, were it not for the detective work done by Detective Postiglione and the Murder Squad, or M Squad as it's known, the elite serial killer and cold case closing unit in Nashville, that came of age during this period. Were it not for their work, you can imagine there would be no limit to where he could have gone and who he could have killed. All again, anonymously. A stranger in the night on the highway, off the books, sitting in the cab of a rig.
Now, I don't know about a lot of other people, but I know, like, you know, when I research these cases and I, you know, you tell me the name and I go and I research it. And then I think to myself, like, all right, I'm going to show this to my students. But I always, for some reason, go back to the beginnings, you know, looking at how they grew up and not in that psych 101 kind of way, just like because of my own interest. So when they went and interviewed his dad said that when he was younger, he would be into, like, you know, he'd be in trouble a lot. He would do these odds and end things that would get him in trouble. But there was something significant that stood out. And he said that Michael had a stepbrother who was killed. And they sort of speculated that it could have been Magliolo who killed him. They could never prove it, and he was never charged with anything, but that was something in his background that I found really just, you know, like a light bulb, you know.
Well, when we look at the number of serial killers, whether it be, you know, Henry Lee Lucas or Ed Kemper or whoever, whose first victims were family members, I mean, it certainly stands to reason. We'll never know how many victims Magliolo has. Again, there's talk of, we're reasonably confident that he carjacked and murdered and had sexual relations with a man in Louisiana. And again, we've talked about polymorphic sexual offenders before. They don't care, man, woman,
they don't pick or choose.
Trans, child, adult, teen, it doesn't matter. And it is correlated with sadism, which again goes back to the Nashville murder, where all the elements of that are there. Prolonged death, prolonged terrorizing of the victim. Again, sadism being arousal from not just pain, but fear and terror as well, and humiliation. And all the telltale indicators are there, which makes... We're confident that that victim in Louisiana is the work of Magliolo, as well as you mentioned his brother as his first victim.
Yeah.
And his ex-wife also said that he would go away for days on end. She wouldn't even know where he was. And she had a hunch that, and they were in Nashville at one time. So she said that was, you know, that could have been linked to what he was, you know,
drew him back there years later when he's living in Texas. And he sees the city is, you know, burgeoning and blossoming, and everyone's moving there. And he knows that it's a stocked pond now of vulnerable victims. You know, people again chasing a dream or chasing the scene, and they're sitting ducks effectively. And again, this murder occurred sort of in the immediate aftermath of the Country Music Awards, where there's also tons of tourists in town, as there is now. I mean, it's a huge tourist town. I mean, before COVID, it was widely known as the New Vegas and the destination for bachelorette parties, and you know, weekend getaways. So
it also, when reading what you were writing about the occupations and stuff, it made me start thinking like, okay, you're right. Like the sociopath or the psychopaths, you know, they sometimes take a little bit more of a more high, more educated job, you know, and then I look at him and I see a messy, messy killer. You know, I didn't see somebody who was that meticulous in covering himself or somebody that would have perfected his skill. He just seemed very messy about it, like leaving clues behind and not tracing, you know. So even when I saw him, it reminded me of just a messy person. And I said to you before the podcast, I said, I don't even know, you know, I would not have gone anywhere with him, because not that I would afraid of him, but he looked shady.
Yeah, he's a beady eyed little.
He looks very shady.
Yeah, creepy dude. And the dichotomy is interesting. You mentioned his crime scenes are very disorganized. He leaves evidence. He alcohol is a factor, as it is with a lot of serial killers, but for the sloppiness of his MO and his crime scenes, his sort of what we call journey to crime, or the decision making and movements and how offenders navigate their physical space and the decisions they make about where to go and what have you, is very organized. As I mentioned, he realizes. I mean, we now know there's 400 to 500 cases that the FBI, unsolved murders that the FBI has attributed to long-haul truckers as part of the Highway Serial Killing Initiative Task Force. But imagine, so those are, we know there's a link between, I mean, the vast majority of long-haul truckers, again, hardworking men and women, law-abiding people who provided essential service, but there is that fraction that are drawn to the job because of their ability to acquire victims and be gone in the night. So imagine someone who doesn't even have the training and doesn't actually perform this work and is just seizing the opportunity of being on the truck. And so he's thought about that. And he's sort of infiltrated this lesser known cash underground profession of lumping. And I wrote that in the book, and in fact, when I was living in Nashville researching this book and visiting Professor Ed Vanderbilt, I had never heard of this. And I find out that, in places like Nashville, Oklahoma City, a lot of these hubs, that it's a thing. And some people do it as for adventure and just sort of to see the country. And some people, it seems, can make a little bit of money at it, maybe. They get a ride and some walking around money. And other people like Magliolo seize upon it for the most sinister of reasons.
I love, you know, and even listening to how we discuss the cases and how we, you know, we interact with them. I think what I'm noticing is that this is so educational, especially because we started out thinking we were going to do this for the students. And then we're like, you know what, let's just take it on the road. But I feel like it really, I'm learning as we go along. So I can only imagine what our students are going to hear and anyone listening to the podcast, because we really set out that we didn't want this to be, you know, and I have to say this because this is something that I always like think about, but I always think about when, you know, there's those two women on the investigation discovery and they're talking and they're like, ooh, wine and crime, let's, you know, and I don't know why, but I was always be offended by it because I'm like, if that was my son or someone that was murdered, I wouldn't want you sitting and drinking wine during that crime. You know, so I want to point out to our listeners that we are very, very, and I always say this, very aware of the victims and their families and just ensuring that what we're doing is coming from an educational standpoint, first and foremost, because I think that's how we approach this from the beginning. And I'd like to stay true to that, you know.
Yep. It's infotainment. And you can tell the story of a crime sort of create a portrait of an offender without trivializing it. And I think that's key. There is, these stories are compelling. So they are, again, infotainment. I don't want to necessarily say entertainment,
right.
But at the same time, why not maybe learn something from it? Get the story and get a takeaway. You know, these aren't public service announcements, but again, the more you know, the more effectively you can navigate this true crime landscape and, you know, talk to people and let them know you know exactly what you're talking about. And
yeah, the students love the background. They love hearing the background of it because that's what, you know, that's what draws them in to be like, why would somebody do this? They can't fully comprehend it. So when you come in and you start explaining your, you know, what you know as a criminologist and bring all that in, it's spectacular for the students to hear, you know, or anyone listening, to be quite honest, because it's really, it's, I'm learning as we go along, like I said, so it's great. And it's always, always a pleasure doing this podcast with you for that reason too. So.
Well, thanks, Dawn. And I think the final takeaway, if we're going to talk about Magliolo, is, so some years ago, in the 70s, and again, this is depicted in Mindhunter and is covered in the Crime Classification Manual, which is sort of the official book that came out of the research that the FBI did along with Ann Burgess in the 70s. And there was this dichotomy of organized versus disorganized offenders. And there was sort of a checklist in terms of what an organized offender is, sort of type A personality, access to a vehicle, usually stably employed, usually in a stable relationship. Pre-plans the crime, etc., versus disorganized, and which would be the opposite of all those. And right. Often crime scenes are attended on foot and are sloppy, they're impulsive. And Magliolo is, I think, an example of the fact that of a third category, which is becoming increasingly acknowledged, which is the mixed category, in that no one offender is going to conform to every item in the checklist of one or the other. I mean, so his crime scenes were very disorganized. His life was chaotic, but he actually maintained stable employment and was effective enough that they had earmarked him to become management at McDonald's. And certainly substance use and there's erratic behavior, antisocial tendencies, but at the same time, this very meticulous vision about how to navigate the country anonymously under various pseudonyms and kill people as his hobby when he's not flipping burgers. So I think, you know, the legacy of this, of his crimes, is that there is not a one-size-fits-all organizational category for each killer. A single killer can have both organized and disorganized elements that can change, you know, as readily as the weather, and that's why we really need to, even today, keep expanding our understanding of the variability and diversity of a killer's tactics.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, it's just, it's a lot of information, but, you know, just even if you take away three takeaways from it, I mean, I know I have. So again, always a pleasure working with you, Michael, this podcast, and, you know, for our listeners out there, always respect to the victims. And, you know, I want to pursue more of the podcast and more of what we're doing. So looking forward to that. Thank you again, and see you next time on Suspect Zero.
Next time on Suspect Zero, the case of Luke Gregoire.